Good morning, Your Honors. Tony Farmani on behalf of Mr. Bobby Langley. Your Honor, this case is fairly straightforward in a sense that at the beginning of the sentencing, the transcript, you have the defense counsel saying, Your Honor, I would like to be very careful. In the beginning of the pre-sentence report, the probation office states that the government has no objections to the pre-sentence report. And here's the critical part. I want to be very careful that that is not the government's position, is not tactically acknowledging that a pre-sentence report is correct and that it is, while it is standing by the plea agreement is not correct. Basically, the defense counsel may have had some discussions with government's counsel and has realized that the government may tactically be acknowledging the plea agreement while at the same time wanting to renege on it. So it brings that out to the
subject. The subject was raised by the pre-sentence report, and the court is, and the probation department is free to come up with what it wants to, and the court is free to look at what it wants to. I have a hard time understanding how this is the prosecution's strategy as opposed to the prosecution responding to plain inquiries directed to it by the pre-sentence report and by the district court itself.
Well, that would be the case, Your Honor, if we didn't have an agreement. We do have
the agreement doesn't change that. You can have all the agreements you want, but the court's not bound by that agreement. The probation department's not bound by that agreement. And the prosecutor is obligated to respond to the court's inquiries.
Correct, Your Honor. But there are two separate things going on here. One is the prosecutor's duty to be candid with the court. The other one is the plea agreement.
Well, you want to pay attention to number two and not number one.
I do. Well, you got to strike a balance between the two, I think.
Well, tell me how the prosecutor failed to do that when the prosecutor says two things. First, here's my response to the court's direct question. Hard to avoid responding to a court's direct question.
Correct.
Second, that being said, we stand by the plea agreement. We feel it's a fair resolution. Isn't that precisely the balance you're talking about?
Well, that would be so, Your Honor, if there wasn't language in the plea agreement that states. And I would go ahead.
Well,
was there a direct question? I thought the question was, do you want to say anything?
Do you want to say anything about all this stuff that's going on?
Is that a direct question telling me how to say something?
And the prosecutor.
Why wasn't the answer no?
Well, the prosecutor saying no?
Yes. In other words, well, if the court didn't say, did it, counsel, was there in fact unauthorized use? That wasn't the question. The question was, prosecutor, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah. Do you have anything to say? And then
the prosecutor could have said no.
No, the prosecutor could have said something that would have been consistent with the plea agreement.
But what if he said no? Would that have been consistent with the plea agreement, i.e., I don't want to say anything?
I think that would have been probably not proper given the circumstances.
Wouldn't it be preferable to what happened?
Well, I think
the question was, do you want to say anything?
I do have a more preferable statement the prosecutor could have said, Your Honor. And that's in this plea agreement. The prosecutor, it states it right here. It says, are consistent with the facts of the case, that the maintainist view that the calculations regarding the total offense level 13 are consistent with the facts of the case. Never, ever the prosecutor says that. In fact, the prosecutor says the exact opposite, does exactly, precisely what the defense counsel
says. What about paragraph 25 of the plea agreement?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
What about paragraph 25 of the plea agreement?
That's what I'm referring to, Your Honor.
The part that says this paragraph permits both the U.S. Attorney's Office and defendant to submit full and complete factual information to the United States Probation Office and the court, even if that factual information may be viewed as inconsistent with the facts agreed to in this agreement? Is that what you're referring to?
But I'm also referring to the rest of the paragraph as well, to maintain this view that the calculations regarding the which is stated in paragraph.
Did the government ever propose a different sentence?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Did the government ever propose a different sentence?
Or a different calculation?
I think the government implicitly, if not explicitly, did.
Well, explicit. Tell me if they did explicitly, Your Honor, that's news to me. So point to it.
Sure. It says government would not want to say anything that would appear to be in breach of the plea agreement. Okay, so that's right there by itself is an implication that the government is not necessarily happy with the plea agreement.
I don't want to plead guilty, so I should take that as a plea of guilty.
No, Your Honor, I would tell you the explicit part of it. Then the court comes back and says, well, I'm not sure what you're telling me, which is an appropriate response to what the government is saying. And then the government comes back and says, I've discussed this case with defense counsel. He's correct in saying that many or most of the times the claimant was not part of the scheme, was part of the scheme and would benefit from it, but not all the time. So there were other means of identification.
Which is exactly what the defendant's sentencing statement said. The defendant's statement said many times it was with authorization.
Yeah, but you also have the defense counsel saying at the same time, you got to take that in, if you put it in context, you have the defense counsel at the same time saying there's no concession or facts anywhere in the plea agreement, which is a controlling
but
document.
In fact, the plea agreement did. It talked about, was it K.A.? Is that the initials?
Yeah, it is.
The initials.
It doesn't say that K.A. ever... that her identity or his identity was
She could have sold that identity. We don't know.
Yeah, she could have. We don't know anything about it.
But doesn't the prosecutor again go on and say, the government will abide by the terms? We feel it's a fair resolution.
Your Honor, what the government does not say, and it should have said, is that the 13 is consistent with the facts of the case. That's
well,
what
abiding
the
by the terms
said.
Of the agreement.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Abiding by the terms of the agreement seems to me to be pretty close. And the line you're drawing, if we draw that here, I'm just trying to think of the kind of guidance it gives prosecutors in responding to direct questions of a district court judge who is saying, I'm not sure what you're saying. Do you want to speak more to this? Because clearly... I want to hear more about this.
Sure. The judge was on the fence and was seeking.
No, not on the fence.
I mean, that's the real problem here. The judge didn't seem to be on the fence. The judge had issued a tentative before he heard one word from the government.
Well, based on what, Your Honor? The PSR doesn't mention
anything. Well, that's a different question. I'd like you to get to that.
I.e.,
what is the information that the unauthorized use is based on, and what do we do about that?
There is absolutely nothing, no evidence, no admission submitted to the court
will
show.
Then we got to deal with K.A.
Right.
You have somebody whose identification is being sold. It is difficult to infer from that the person whose identification is being sold consents and authorizes the use of identification by somebody else. The only logical inference is that person isn't authorizing the use. And the district court says as much in denying the bail application, saying that gave reason to believe that there had been a misuse of identification.
Your Honor, if I sold my information to someone, and that person in turn sells it to another.
Suppose you sold my law clerk's information to someone. Should I infer that he gave authorization to you to sell the information? Because it wasn't K.A. that sold it.
You can't infer one or the other.
Sure you can.
You may have very well.
We infer that all the time.
Well, we don't know whether it was K.A. who sold it, do we?
In
the first instance.
Yeah, K.A. could have sold it to someone else. And that person sold it to Bobby.
Have you ever heard of somebody selling his own Social Security
Absolutely,
number?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Selling his own Social
not
Security
social,
number?
We don't know if this was a Social Security number that K.A. sold. We know it was an identification number. We don't know. It could have very well been a credit card number. It could have very well been her ID.
Defendant sold N.S. a Social Security card and driver's license with the identity K.A. that he had purchased. So it wasn't K.A. selling its own information. It was defendant selling to N.S. information about K.A. Now, how can we infer from that K.A. gave away this information for your client to sell? Is that a logical inference? I don't think so.
I think that you're saying there's absolutely no one. I apologize, Your Honor, for not
I'm not saying absolutely no one. I'm saying it is a reasonable inference, and that's all the district court needs to go on, isn't it? A reasonable inference? You don't have to have a signed confession for every piece of the logical, the line of logic. This is a reasonable inference. The district court drew the inference. What's wrong with drawing that inference?
I don't think that inference would be, given the fact that the government itself looked at the evidence and did not feel that it was appropriate
That's a different issue. The government may have decided it wasn't appropriate to seek that sentence. But that's not the same as saying there was zero evidence to support the inference drawn by the district court. That's the argument you're on now. And it seems to me that this statement within the plea agreement, specifically identifying the sale of KA's information and your client's sale of it, your client's participation in setting up a bank account, that's evidence. And the district court pointed specifically to that evidence in denying bail. So what's wrong with that evidence being relied upon by the district court?
Well, the underlying premise would be that every single person or most likely person would not authorize.
No, I'm willing to authorize to say that it's not an illogical inference that people don't sell their own Social Security and information to open up false bank accounts and false identities and so forth.
But for that,
people pay money to keep their Social Security information being released to the outside world.
But telling you, Your Honor, that never came out in the tentative.
But your client also.
Or in the sentencing.
But your client's lawyer is also standing before the district court and not taking the position that every one of these identifying numbers was voluntarily released for use by your client.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor.
That's another consistent factor with the line of inferences that Judge Clifton is talking about.
I agree. It is a difficult hurdle to overcome when defense counsel is saying a lot and not saying all. But, you know, you also have defense counsel adamantly arguing that there's never a concession or any evidence indicating that
there's a concession. There may not be evidence.
Or in a plea agreement, it says. And I think what the defense counsel was anticipating was going in there and the government abiding by the plea agreement. And what the government did is precisely what defense counsel feared that he would do and pointed out to the court initially.
Okay.
But I do understand what Judge Clifton is pointing to, and I acknowledge that.
All right. Your time is up. We'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jeannie Joseph on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, I respectfully submit that the government did not explicitly or implicitly breach the plea agreement in this case.
There's a sentence in paragraph 25. I can't tell whether you're relying on it or not, but it's a very peculiar sentence because it says, this paragraph permits both the U.S. attorney and defendant to submit full and complete factual information to the probation office and the court, even if that factual information may be viewed as inconsistent with the facts agreed to in this agreement, but does not affect defendants and USAO's obligations not to contest the facts agreed to in this agreement. What does that mean? It seems to be saying two completely inconsistent things.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's exactly what the government was obliged to do in this case, in fact. And I'm familiar with that because it goes into all of the plea agreements
but
that we've
very
had.
Next question.
Is that boilerplate?
That is boilerplate, Your Honor.
It's boilerplate, but it's somewhat nonsensical.
Well, it has to do with this situation, Your Honor, where the government is obliged to abide by the plea agreement. At the same time, it's required to respond truthfully and provide truthful information to the court, which is what happened here.
But you see, the way the sentence is written, it doesn't depend on being asked.
That's true, Your Honor. Because it can come up in all sorts of contexts. But that's exactly the point of that particular paragraph. I remember when it was added to the plea agreements as part of its standard language in response to some case law.
All right, but in this instance, what are the district judge, as I said before, the district judge didn't say, you know, Mr. Assistant U.S. Attorney, was there or wasn't there? Do you not have evidence that there was unauthorized use?
Well, Your Honor, not explicitly.
Well,
that
even
was the implicit question.
He said, do you want to say anything?
Well, Your Honor,
the answer could have been, no, I don't want to say anything.
Your Honor, what preceded that was the court asking, do you want to speak to the issue of unauthorized use of identification?
And the answer could have been no, I don't.
Well, the government's response at that point was basically no, because the government said, I don't want to say anything that would appear to be in breach of the plea agreement.
Right.
The government came up with this plea agreement during its negotiations and thinks it's a fair deal and is making a recommendation in line with that agreement.
And then
it
the judge
doesn't
says,
want to
I don't know what you're saying. And then he said,
That's
then,
right.
Then all of a sudden he goes into this other thing. But he never asked him. He never asked him specifically.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that respectfully that when the court, the government gives that response and the court says, I'm not sure what you're telling me.
As in,
then,
answer the question?
Is right,
that district
as in,
court
you
speak
haven't,
or answer the question?
And I was there, Your Honor. The court clearly seemed to be inquiring of me, what is your answer to this question?
What
and
question?
So I responded.
Do you want to speak about this?
About
that was the only question. Do you want to speak about this?
About, we'd just gone over discussing the court about the unauthorized use of identification enhancement. The court asked me about it. I say
but
I'd rather
he,
not speak
see,
about
but
it.
He didn't ask you about it. He asked you whether you wanted to talk about it.
Your Honor, that was, well, I think in the entire context of that part of the conversation where he had just discussed it with defense counsel has responded. He turns to the government. He asks the government, what about this? The government
do
responds.
You want to talk about this is what I asked you.
Right. Your Honor,
like
and then his
that as an offer that you couldn't refuse.
That's correct, Your Honor. I felt I had a duty of candor to respond to his question. When I tried to just simply say I abided by the plea agreement, the court inquired of me further, what are you telling me?
So is it your position that the court says, and says, here's my question, you say, I don't want to talk about it, the court comes back and says, I don't understand what you're telling me, you haven't answered the question, do you want to speak to the question, and then you have to say something more pointed?
Yes, Your Honor. And the I actually say, if you're asking
about
the...
Have I accurately described how you think it went?
That's correct, Your Honor. And so when the court asked me again, or I asked, are you asking me about the unauthorized use of identification enhancement? And the court says, right. I felt I was obligated to respond to the court's question. But how I responded was simply to reiterate what defense counsel had already said in his sentencing brief and orally at that sentencing
hearing.
Oh, not exactly. Excuse me?
Not exactly. You said specifically, and he never did, that there were instances in which there was unauthorized use. He may have implied it, but he never said it.
Your Honor, yes, but the implicit admission was there, and the court noted it already in its tentative brief. The court noted that defense counsel did not object to the statement in the PSR that some of the identification information was used without authorization. That was not objected to. And then defense counsel in his sentencing brief and at the sentencing said, look, most or a lot, I believe the word is, a lot of them were used with authorization. That implicitly admits that some were not. And the court noted that in its tentative brief before the government ever said anything. So I think that in this case, the government explicitly stated on the record multiple times the offense level calculation was correct. It was abiding by the plea agreement, and it made a low-end recommendation. It never made any other recommendation to the court. There wasn't an implicit breach because the government responded to the court's question, had a duty of candor to do so. It did so in line with exactly what defense counsel had said. It offered no new information. As the court found, what the government did here was codified in paragraph 25 of the plea agreement. The government here never expressed any reservations about what it was recommending, unlike some of the cases cited by the defendant. Like the Johnson's case, the government here said, I am bound by the plea agreement and I abide by it. And this court found in the Johnson case that that does not suggest a harsher sentence in any way. The government
what about the other question, i.e. the adequacy of the record with regard to unauthorized use?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The adequacy of the record with regard to unauthorized use.
Sure, Your Honor. I will turn to that. As the court mentioned, the defendant has the burden of establishing clear error that the district court's decision here was illogical or implausible or not based on any inference that can be reasonably drawn from the record. Here we had the pre-sentence report, which made a finding that at least some of the identification.
But there was no clarity to it at all. It was just totally, it was an assertion.
Correct, Your Honor, but it was not objected to by defense counsel.
Well, it was, because he said that wasn't, he said just what I said. That wasn't adequate and it didn't support the conclusion.
And then, Your Honor, in addition, defense counsel.
I don't know what you mean when you say he didn't object to it. He specifically objected to the unauthorized use on the ground that the record didn't support it.
He objected only on the basis that most of the
– No, on the ground that there just simply wasn't a record showing that there was any unauthorized use.
Okay, Your Honor, the defendant also –
Does that change the burden?
I'm sorry.
Does that change the burden if there was an objection?
I don't know. I think it's a clear error burden regardless.
Well, clear error burden here, but there correct. Still has to be something in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. But in addition to the PSR unobjected to, in addition to that.
I don't understand. Oh, well, let's watch the unobjected to. It was objected to. Go ahead.
There was the defendant's own admissions in his sentencing brief as well as at the sentencing hearing that, again, we talked about this, the implicit concession, that because a lot of them were authorized, some of them clearly were not. He never stated otherwise, and that was the court's finding. In addition, as Your Honors noted, in the plea agreement and the factual basis, there is, as to count three to which the defendant was pleading, there is the stipulated factual statement that the defendant purchased KA's information and sold it to NS or the CS.
I understand, despite Judge Clifton's certainty, I have a very hard time understanding why that tells you anything about what KAC's role in any of A, do we know that KAC even existed, number one. Number two, how do we know that she wasn't in the business of, or she wasn't, you know, hard up for money and said, here, I'll sell you my ID and do what you want with it?
Well, I think it comes down to what is a reasonable inference.
Well, why? Why is it a reasonable inference about anything?
I believe if someone is selling, first of all, by reference to the initials of KA, it refers to an actual person. That's typically how people are referred to.
A person who purports to be an actual person, i.e., there's an ID with her name on it, but what does that prove?
Well, as opposed to a plea agreement that states that the defendant made up or made up a Social Security number or a fictitious person, the plea agreement could have said that. It did not. It said that the defendant sold the Social Security and driver's license information of KA, again, presumably
KA's name on it. Yeah.
KA's, right, to someone else, okay, to use a co-schemer in a fraud scheme that involves submitting fictitious claims for disability for fictitious people. So that was the entire factual basis. So I think a reasonable presumption.
If it's a fictitious person, then is that an unauthorized use if it's a fictitious person?
Well, fictitious person in the sense of the employer scheme. What the scheme involves is real people pretending
to
be.
What's the answer to that, by the way? I mean, I don't know. I mean, with regard to the unauthorized use, does it include fictitious people?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Okay.
It relates to real people. But again, so in the context, when I say fictitious people, this was a scheme where they were fictitious employees. They were real people pretending to be employees of a fictitious employer. And so in line with this entire factual basis, we have as to count three within, as an act within the scheme, the selling of Kay's information to a co-schemer to be used in the scheme. I think there is a reasonable inference to be made there that there was the use, unauthorized use of KA's identification information. In addition, I think this is a case that actually falls within harmless error as far as the application of that enhancement. And that's because the defendant is not challenging on appeal the sophisticated means enhancement. And thus, if you take away the unauthorized use of identification enhancement, you get to a guideline range where the 21-month sentence the court imposed is still within that range.
But where in the record do we find a statement by the court saying, even if there wasn't this enhancement, even if there was a two-level less offense-level calculation, that I would nonetheless impose a 21-month sentence, the high end of what would be the correct guideline range absent the enhancement, as opposed to the low end of the guideline range that he thought applied?
I think in a couple places, Your Honor. I think in the tentative sentencing memorandum the court did, which is quite detailed, it sums up that it is finding this sentence on all the 3553 factors, not just based upon the guidelines calculation, which it considered discretionary, and that in addition, when the court came up with that 21-month sentence, it was not the sentence recommended by either the parties who presented a united front or by the probation office who was recommending a 27-month sentence. The court came up with this sentence on its own. And so I think because of those reasons, the harmless error analysis would apply here as far as that, whether or not that enhancement was appropriately applied in the case. And okay. I think I would cite Munoz Camarena on that.
Right.
On that.
Thank you. You're over your time. Thank you
Thank
for
you
your argument. I'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal. Go ahead.
Sure. I'll make it brief. I just wanted to address a couple of minor points. One would be the united front concept here, which is the case law is very clear on this, that it requires the government to essentially stand in the position of defense counsel, to stand right behind defense counsel and recommend, actually recommend the sentence. What we have here, although very subtly, what we have is the exact opposite. And then secondly, Your Honor, with regard to the KA's information, the paragraph says, defendant sold NS a social security card and driver's license with the identity K that he had purchased. We don't know where he purchased it from. We don't know if he purchased it from KA.
And we don't know if KA was an actual person.
We don't. And what is interesting here, Your Honor, is that many were, in fact.
So why would the inference to that effect be clearly erroneous?
Well, you know, there's got to be more.
That's
I mean,
the standard.
There's got to be more.
Well,
I mean,
No. There is an inference drawn by the judge based upon that statement in the plea agreement that there was an unauthorized use of KA's identification. Why is that inference clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, well, let me just
Is that the right standard?
I don't believe that necessarily is the correct standard, Your Honor. Why? I think the district court is obligated to do more. I think this information about KA came after the
district court makes its factual finding, and we review it for clear error. Are you telling me there's a different standard that applies?
I don't think the district court, in fact, the district court did not make this actual finding at sentencing. It was after the fact, after the government, neither did the probation officer, after the government filed an opposition to a motion for bail pending appeal, all this stuff about KA came out. And then the district court, after remand from this court, went back to the district court. The district judge had to provide reasons for the denying bail and specified and just basically copied what the government has said. And that, to me, is indicative that there was no evidence. If there were such evidence, then the government would have asked for the enhancement. The government didn't ask for
the
enhancement.
Well, the government's negotiating. We don't know what the government's bargaining positions were other than what's revealed in the record or why it decided to negotiate the terms that it negotiated.
It was never revealed in the record, Your Honor. It was never revealed at sentencing. Defense counsel never had an opportunity to attack that finding. Never. I mean, well, this finding just came out of nowhere.
Defense counsel had been arguing many and most. Defense counsel had never been saying none or never until the issue comes up at oral argument.
Your Honor, correct, but, you know, defense counsel does say there's never, I mean, I think a fair reading, however. In
defense counsel never says never. He says no evidence, which turns out not to be correct. But there is no affirmative statement that there was never misuse or unauthorized use of identification of information from other people.
I agree that defense counsel here fell short. I believe the defense counsel could have done more, but I think if we review the entire transcript, as I'm sure Your Honor has, a fair reading of it would reflect the defense counsel was adamantly arguing against this enhancement because Mr. Langley anticipated, and rightfully so, Your Honor, based on case law, that he would be sentenced to 12 months and one day.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both counsel. The case of United States versus Langley is submitted, and we will go to the last case for this panel. Hart Pence versus Kinetic Concepts.